He immediately held a very long press conference afterwards and said he would do exactly the same again.
In mid-February 2003, just before the Iraq invasion, tens of millions of demonstrators in hundreds of cities across the world, including in London, marched against the impending U.S.-led war in the Middle East. To Tony Blair, the biggest protest march in British history was fatuous.
The fact is that had we been listened to and had Britain not taken part in the war almost certainly would not have taken place, that America would have been much less likely to go to war alone, and we would have seen a much different world today, a day where far more people would be alive as a result of that war not happening, would be far fewer refugees.
The U.S. claimed the regime of former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein possessed weapons of mass destruction and actively pressed for invading Iraq in late 2001. The weapons were never found. Two decades on, 1 million Iraqis dead, 3 million dispossessed, and a region reeling from terrorism and instability. Hundreds of British troops were also killed in the same conflict. Anti-war campaigners say Tony Blair belongs in the dock at The Hague, and not in the pantheon of great leaders. Saeed Pourreza, London.
Hezbollah Secretary General Said Hassan Nasrallah lashed out at the United States as the mother of corruption and terrorism in the region and stressed that the expulsion of U.S. forces from the region will be the final revenge for the U.S. assassination of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani and Iraqi Popular Mobilization Unit's commander Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis in Baghdad in 2020.
We have declared earlier that the best revenge is the full withdrawal of U.S. troops from the region. And over the past 2 years, as the leader Imam Sayyid Ali Khamenei said, the U.S. has been forced to leave Afghanistan with humiliation. This has led the U.S. allies to rethink their alliance with Washington.
In an address to a ceremony in Beirut remembering the martyrs Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis and their companions, Sayyid Nasrallah also accused the U.S. of being behind all Israeli and Saudi crimes in the region for decades.
The lesson which I would like to highlight today is that everyone acting for the sake of God emerges victorious in all battles and wins the hearts and minds of all people across the Arab and Muslim worlds. They show us that the U.S. serves as a real enemy and source of corruption, occupation, and terrorism in our region.
Analysts believe that the project of the resistance continues to face the criminality of the U.S. in Lebanon and the region.
Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani belonged to the school of thought of a struggle against the occupiers of our land and those who destroyed our homes and killed our people and led one war after the other with their support for the Zionists. He sacrificed his life and stood against terrorism in Iraq, Yemen, Syria, and Lebanon and Palestine. He taught us that Lebanon is strong enough and can remove itself from the U.S. hegemony.
The leader of the resistance stressed that the assassination of martyr Soleimani, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, has triggered a new phase at the regional level.
The assassination of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani and PMU Commander Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis is seen as an incident larger than the region itself, and for many analysts has brought to light a long-term confrontation for Lebanon's Hezbollah facing U.S. influence in Lebanon and the region. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani is highly respected among Afghan people because of his leadership role in resisting invasion and Takfiri groups in the region. Afghans consider him as a hero who inspired them to find freedom and defeat the invaders. To commemorate Lieutenant General Soleimani's sacrifices and bravery, Afghan leaders, clerics, and experts gathered at the Iranian embassy in Kabul, highlighting his role in unifying Muslims and forming an anti-terror resistance in the region, especially Afghanistan.
Martyr Soleimani was a righteous servant of God. He was committed to Islam's holy values and ideals, so he devoted his life to serve Muslims and the oppressed and fight devils and takfiri groups. He fought the U.S. hegemony in the region and didn't let it interfere in Islamic countries' affairs and create terror and war in the region.
Shahid Qasem Soleimani.
Martyr Soleimani managed to unify Muslims around the globe. He always used to show up wherever he was needed. For Afghanistan, he was a friend. He met resistance forces and Afghan top leaders to motivate and empower them to defend their soil against terrorists and invaders. Therefore, we owe the victory over the US to the anti-terror, General Soleimani.
Some Afghan teenagers, considering themselves as the followers of Lieutenant General Soleimani's school of thought, have held the Sunday Wushu match on the occasion of the second anniversary of the martyrdom of their fearless role model.
All matches held here in support of Commander Soleimani. We, the young generation of Afghanistan, are followers of his school of thought. We love the commander's attitude and adopt him as our role model in bravery, faith, and modesty. That is why most matches are named after him.
Lieutenant General Soleimani not only played a major role in defeating Daesh terrorist group in Syria and Iraq, but also had a direct relation with Afghan resistance forces to help them defeat terrorist groups and put an end to invasion on their soil. Afghans marked the second anniversary of the U.S. assassination of the anti-terror commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, as they are still suffering from time-to-time Daesh attacks. For Afghans, Martyr Soleimani is a hero and a role model for fighting against terrorism. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
The second anniversary of the assassination of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani was marked with a lecture which detailed the life and good works of the former leader of the Quds Force of Iran's Revolutionary Guards Corps. The participants praised the sterling quality of his character, especially his selfless fight against terrorist groups.
He was killed for his fight against this terrorism. And he need to be remembered. We must remember General Qasem Soleimani for his bravery and standing against injustice. He fight against the extrajudicial killing of innocent people by the so-called ISIS and other terrorist organizations.
General Soleimani and his fellow Iraqi commander Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis were assassinated in a targeted drone attack on the 3rd of January 2020 in the Iraqi capital, Baghdad, with orders from then US President Donald Trump. People here say the assassination of General Soleimani has revealed the true identity of terror sponsors to the world.
Those that claim to be fighting against terrorism kill a hero, somebody who fights against terrorism. Now, who are the terrorists? America is the perpetrators of terrorism in the world. It is very clear to the whole world that these are the global sponsors and perpetrators of terrorism in the world.
Military hospital.
In a message to the occasion, Nigeria's senior Muslim cleric Sheikh Ibrahim Al-Zazaki said the Islamic movement in Nigeria will continue to mark the assassination of General Soleimani, just like it marks other martyrs in Karbala, Zaria, and other places. Nigerians who gathered here say they share the pain of the Iranian people and indeed of all law-abiding nations of the world who stand against extrajudicial killing like that of General Qasem Soleimani by the U.S. government. Danjuma Abdullahi, Abuja.
After almost 140 days of his hunger strike, the 40-year-old Palestinian prisoner Hisham Abu Hawash is in imminent danger, facing the risk of sudden death at any moment. Representatives of Palestinian factions and prisoners' advocacy groups in the occupied Ramallah took to the streets again, sounding the alarm over the health condition of Abu Hawash, who is protesting his illegal administrative detention without charge or trial.
My brother Hisham could die at any moment. This is according to medical reports by the doctors who have directly examined Hisham. We are really worried about his health. Israel is using a new form of assassination against our brothers.
The International Committee of the Red Cross has meanwhile issued a statement demanding Israel to immediately release Abu Hawash. Israel claims it keeps some Palestinians behind bars without disclosing sensitive information that could expose valuable sources. In the case of Abu Hawash, Israeli intelligence claims he's an activist of the jihad movement. However, it was not able to provide explicit evidence in support of its allegations. Palestinian human rights organizations say it's yet another attempt to bring Palestinian prisoners to their knees and prevent them from being engaged in any form of struggle.
My brother Hisham could die at any moment. This is according to medical reports by the doctors who have directly examined him. We are really worried about his health. Israel is using a new form of assassination against our brothers.
Last month, the Israeli regime accepted to release hunger-striking prisoner Kaid al-Fasfus after 131 days of his protest, where his release was seen as yet another form of victory. As Israel reportedly holds over 4,500 Palestinian prisoners, hundreds of them are languishing behind bars without charge or trial under the illegal so-called administrative detention. Palestinians pray that Abu Hawash's life could be saved before it's too late. Abu Hawash, who's literally on the verge of death, has said before his health severely deteriorated that he will continue his hunger strike until victory. That is, according to him, his release or his martyrdom. Mona Qandil, Occupy Ramallah.
Inside the former U.S. Embassy in Tehran, Iranian judicial experts gathered to reveal the details of a probe into the U.S. assassination of Iranian top military commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. General Soleimani was the commander of the Quds Force of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, which is in charge of conducting overseas operations. He was assassinated in January 2020 in a U.S. drone strike outside Baghdad International Airport on a direct order from then U.S. President Donald Trump.
The U.S. justifies its crime by branding it as self-defense or targeted killing. There is no such legal term in the international law. It is an assassination and cannot be justified by fake terms. It's an extrajudicial murder which violates the UN resolutions 1368 and 1370. Furthermore, based on the Chicago Convention, the use of UAVs in another sovereign country requires the permission of that country. Iraq says it did not give such a permission to the U.S. to carry out this strike.
Iran and Iraq have formed a joint investigation committee comprised of Iraqi and Iranian judicial experts. Based on the latest findings of the legal team, more than 120 people have been identified in connection with General Soleimani's assassination. Former U.S. President Donald Trump tops the list.
General Soleimani was on a mission to Iraq, a mission that concerns the fight against terrorism. The Convention on Special Missions protects the rights of General Soleimani, but Washington breached that convention as well. So all these violations of international law are considered a crime, and we are taking the case to international judicial bodies to penalize the perpetrators.
General Soleimani holds a reputation for eliminating Daesh terrorists in Iraq in 2017. He also led major operations in Syria that led to the recapturing of key areas from the terror group. That's why his assassination is viewed as a huge loss for the region and a big win for the terrorists, something which experts say leads to a safe interpretation that Washington must be on the terrorists' team.
2 years have passed since General Soleimani was assassinated, and Iran is still as resolute to prosecute those behind the incident. Iran's judiciary calls the culprits the terrorists' comrades, saying it will not stop until all perpetrators are brought to justice. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
In a press conference in the capital Sana'a, Yemen's Eye for Humanity Center for Rights and Development released its new report on the Saudi crimes committed against Yemenis during 2021. The report highlights the number of victims of the Saudi air attacks and the destruction of the country's infrastructure.
Recently, the Saudi-led coalition has escalated its raids against civilian facilities and residential areas crowded with civilians in Yemen and tried to justify this by saying that there were military activities in those areas, which was not true. We monitor all the crimes of the Saudi-led coalition and the victims who fall in Saudi airstrikes and mortar shelling.
The report says Saudi warplanes have launched over 9,900 airstrikes against civilian facilities across Yemen last year, killing 387 civilians, including 96 children, and injuring hundreds more. In a previous report, the human rights group said more than 43,000 civilians had been hurt or killed in relentless air strikes across Yemen since Saudi Arabia launched a war on its southern neighbor in 2015. It said nearly 4,000 children were among those killed.
As people around the world celebrate the New Year with festivals and joyful events, Yemenis enter a new year of war and siege imposed on their country by Saudi Arabia. People here believe that the years-long resistance will eventually bring Riyadh to justice for its crimes in Yemen. Abdulatif Loshali, Sana'a.
This is Back to Reality.
Back to Reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Back to Reality, where we discuss various topics and then bring you back to reality. I'm your humble host, Muzaffar Haider. Here in the studio today, we have with us my main man, Brother Ja'far. Assalamu alaikum to you, brother.
Alaikum salam. Thank you for having me.
It's good to have you. We go way back. And we have Sister Zainab. Assalamu alaikum, Sister Zainab.
Alaikum assalam.
Where are you from?
I'm from Indian Administrative Kashmir.
Why do Muslims swear? You know, sometimes we swear by something. If I want to make clear that I'm actually speaking the truth about something, I'll say, I swear, for example, on so-and-so's grave. Or I'll say, I swear by God, you know, which is a huge thing to do. Huge thing to do. Why do we do it? What is the significance behind this? Even Allah swears by certain things. He swears by, you know, so many different things in the Quran. You know, he says, "Wadduha," I swear by the morning, I swear by the mountains, "Wattur," and so on and so forth. It goes on and on and on. Why?
It's different when it comes to humans and when it comes to Allah about swearing. When humans swear, they want to stress something, they want to emphasize on something that I literally mean this. But when Allah swears in Quran, he has so much, his swearing is so much, you know, at place. It's so much, for example, if you talked about Allah, he says in one of the surahs, "Wal Asr, I swear by time, the human being is in loss." Now, if you try to find a connection, what is it? What is the difference between this? Why Allah sweared by time? And why is He swearing by time if human being is in loss? Whenever we invest in something, whenever we invest, we see the gain and loss only at the same time.
Uh-huh.
But here, Allah is swearing by time. That means human beings are investing time. And in return, they are not getting anything.
Uh-huh.
But then He makes a condition, only the people who watawaso bil haq and watawaso bil sabr, which means only the people who suggest others to come towards truth and who suggest others to come towards patience, and at the same time they have the capacity to accept the truth, to, you know, to have the patience themselves as well. So when Allah swears in Quran, it has a great meaning. He is swearing by time because we are losing time.
Mm-hmm.
He says you are in loss, and this loss and time is completely connected. Whenever he swears in Quran, he wants to wake up us from that dormant sleep.
Okay, we'll come back to Allah's swearing, because I think that's a lengthy topic in and of itself. Inshallah, we'll come back to it. Why do we swear? Why do, like, if I'm trying to prove something to you right now, Brother Ja'far, well, why do I need to say, I swear by God?
Because he does not believe you.
He doesn't believe me. Uh-huh. Why don't you believe me? And why do I have to swear to make you believe me?
Well, I guess it's just people's intuition towards other people. Again, we've said it before, where people don't always believe, suppose, the person in front of them. Right? So just to really push the idea that, look, I'm not lying, you know, I'm trying to tell you the truth here, they swear to something. And I guess the epitome of that, the highest point that you can reach, is God. Right? But to what Sister Zainab said, like, I can understand, and I think most people understand that concept, where you can't compare these two swearings with one another because they're at completely different levels, mm-hmm. right? A human swearing, whether it's a good swearing or cursing someone, is completely different from something that where God is swearing in the Quran, right? Mm-hmm. When God is swearing in the Quran, he's showing the importance of something, right? He's letting us know. He's making us aware about, look, I've given you day and night. I've given you, suppose, mountains and skies. I've given you time. Make the most of it,
yeah.
right? Don't waste these blessings I've given you. But when a human does it, typically it's, you know, listen to what I'm saying. Don't take what I said for granted, right? It's this, to an extent, it's the same concept, but with just less of an authority behind it.
Okay, here we go. We'll be right back.
Please send any suggestion, any idea to our email, that is englishradio@irib.ir.
Why do we have to swear by something? Like, why can't I just say, I swear, I am telling the truth? Why is that not sufficient? Why do I have to take some object or something which exists? I swear by my mum. Why do people have to do that? Because I swear by Allah, some people will take it to that extent. Why?
Well, I don't think that human swearing is very much, you know, it's in fact, we are recommended in Islam that not to do that, not to swear much. In fact, if you swear on something and you're, that's no truth, you have to give kafara, you have to pay for that. But when I say that I swear on my mom or sometimes I swear on Allah, I'm again stressing. I'm trying to prove my point twice or thrice. Or like, I want to make my point twofold, threefold, or the multiple fold. Like, maximum is Allah. When I say I swear by Allah, that means I am putting maximum emphasis on this point. I'm making it much bolder. Whatever I'm trying to tell you, listen to it.
Yeah.
Because you feel like the other person is not listening to you.
If I told you something, you okay. didn't believe me, and then I said, I swear by the life of George Bush, would you believe me?
No.
Why?
Because George Bush is not someone who is close to you, who is connected to you, who can be important for you. You swear only by the things or people who are very important to you, who mean a lot to you.
I guess it also depends on what or who you're swearing upon, right? And if it's someone who has no, I guess, substantial value in the eyes of the other person, then they won't take it seriously.
Uh-huh.
Right? Just like the sister said, you're trying to really push an idea here, right? You're trying to show that it means a lot to you and you really want them to believe what you're saying.
Yeah.
Right? So now if I say, I swear by this table, it's like, who cares if you swear by this table? There's no intensity for me, right?
Yeah.
There's no urgency on my end here by saying, oh, look, I swear by this cup or I swear by this table, right? So the level of, or I guess the thing you attribute your swear to also shows your intensity for it.
Uh-huh.
Right? It shows like how much you're really trying to go behind something.
Mm-hmm. Have you ever sworn by something? Like in a discussion or sister, have you? Or
I guess sometimes, maybe if some very close friend of mine got some kind of, some misunderstanding arised and I wanted to clear it and I knew the person would believe it very easily, I may have used that, but I don't remember right now.
Uh-huh.
But I may have, just in order to like make that, keep that healthy relationship a healthy one,
yeah.
not to, uh-huh. you know, let uh-huh. that misunderstanding overcome it.
So it's reminding me now that back in school in the UK, I used to be like, you know, I swear on my life. Mm-hmm. The kids always used to say that, I swear on my life. And then you would have to believe it if they said that. So it's interesting that you have to swear by something which has kind of a sacredness to you.
It's something that you hold
very close to yourself.
Yeah, it's something close to you. It's something that holds value in your eyes and also in the person who you're swearing to, I guess.
So let's talk about some of the things that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala swears by in the Quran. I mean, it's really interesting. The sister, you mentioned the time.
Wal-asr,
he swears by time. He swears by Wat-tur-sinin.
Wat-tur-sinin.
Right? Yeah. He swears by the mountain of Sinai. And he swears by Wal-adiyati wat-tahha. He swears by the riders when they are riding in the night or just before the dawn. Why?
So, as I said before, when God's swearing here, he's trying to show the importance behind it, right?
Yeah.
Whether it's, suppose, the mountains or the skies or time in general, he's trying to show you, God's trying to show you the importance of these things. Like, look, I've given you these blessings. Don't just go through this life without taking these into account, right? Look, I've given these things to help you to, in a sense, enrich you and help you reach, like, perfection.
Yeah.
Right? So, like, from what I understood here is that, look, God didn't just, suppose, swear on one thing. He showed you the multitude of blessings that he's given you. And he's sweared on quite a few in the Quran as well, just to show the importance and how we should incorporate these things into our life.
We're speaking about swear by something.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Back to Reality.
Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala swears, like, La uqsimu bi hadha al-balad. He says, I swear by this city. You know, here Allah even uses the word uqsimu, you know, I swear. He's literally saying it. Other places he just says, wa. Whoa. So when you read the consequent verses, it gives you that much more attention to the detail, and you take what Allah is swearing, not just that which he is swearing by, but why he's swearing by that thing more seriously. It does have a huge impact on the way that you read the Quran when you recognize the greatness and the importance of those things that he's swearing by.
I say that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, if he wanted to swear, you know, sometimes you see, like, he's swearing on one thing, then on another thing, then on another thing. It seems like as if, you know, it's if a reader reads it, like, without contemplation, he'll get distracted. Yeah. But since we see Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is Hakim, there's wisdom. If these things were not connected, even if his swearings were not connected to each other, these swearings would have come into some another surah. Yeah. Like you said, Tur Sinin, the first and the... I don't remember that right now, but Allah swears by three different things. But then when you analyze them,
Wat-tini wa-zaytun.
What does Allah mean over here? Why do you think, like, he's, you know, swearing on some something like some this tree or that tree? He wants to swear on a land, on a land of teen that was and a land of zaytun. It was like on the land of olive. And then Tur Sinin is again a land where from Musa uses to talk to me. And then again some verse like that, it's again a land where I blessed, where I sent the prophets. So Allah in all these three verses is swearing about the land. Land of these trees that dates back to Syria of this time and the Palestine of this time. So Allah is basically swearing by the lands of Palestine, Syria, the land where Musa used to talk to me, and the land where I blessed with prophets. And then when you go through another ayahs of the surah, you find a definite connection. All these ayahs are completely connected with each other, like we saw in Wal Asr. Allah sweared by time, and then he connected that time. Why he sweared by time? Because one was losing his time, one was losing his life. Allah is basically swearing by our life. And why Allah swears so much in Quran? I guess there are the maximum number of swearings is in Surah Shams. And why he swears so much? Because human being is in ghaflat. He's dormant, he's sleeping. He is not aware. He knows this thing is right and this thing is wrong. But at the same time, he gets into...
He doesn't have a deep understanding of what's going around.
No, he gets into that dormant sleep. You know, it becomes less important for him. So when things become less important for him, Allah comes and, you know, swears in Quran, making it more bold, making it much more... highlighting it for us, you know. Hey, get up. Wake up. You know this thing. Now.
Yes, yeah, kind of like an alert to wake us up.
Alert, yeah.
And I suppose to an extent it demonstrates the profound mercy of Allah as well. Because usually when we are swearing by something, we're trying to prove ourselves in front of somebody. In other words, we have some kind of need for that person to believe in what we're saying. You know, it might be that we're in a courtroom and we need to hold our hand on the Bible or on the Quran and swear that I swear to tell the truth and nothing but the truth, they say in court. We're trying to prove our innocence here. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala does not need to prove his innocence, God forbid, to anyone. Nor does he have any kind of need for us. He doesn't need anybody to believe in him. And yet, out of his infinite mercy, he's doing this very, I dare I say it, this very human thing of swearing by something in order for us to just believe in that thing.
Just to wake up, basically.
Just to wake us up. I mean, that is beautiful. Thank you very much for your ideas and thoughts. It's been a profound discussion today. That's all we have time for, unfortunately. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Ya Rabbi, let the ummah rise again.
Ya Allah.
يا رب العالمين يا رحمن يا رحيم يا ربي let the ummah rise again let us see daylight again once again
This is the Heart of Life pounding. IRIB English Radio.
The Limelight. Growing drive by hardcore Trumpists spurs US election watchdogs to voice alarm about threat to America's democracy. Here we present you an article written by Peter Stone. The piece is titled Bannon and Allies Bid to Expand Pro-Trump Influence in Local US Politics. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. Key Donald Trump loyalists Steve Bannon and Michael Flynn are at the forefront of a drive to expand Trumpist influence at the local level of U.S. politics, while forging ahead with efforts aimed at promoting baseless claims that Joe Biden's 2020 election victory was fraudulent. The growing drive by Trump's hardcore allies has spurred election watchdog groups to voice alarm about the threat to democracy posed by Michael Flynn and Steve Bannon, and other Trump acolytes, as they combine debunked claims about election fraud and calls for further 2020 election audits, with planning conservative takeovers of official positions that run U.S. elections. The moves come a year after the attack on the Capitol in Washington, when a pro-Trump mob invaded the building in an attempt to stop the certification of Joe Biden's election victory. Michael Flynn and Steve Bannon, using varying paths, have focused new energy on increasing conservative influence by recruiting more allies for key posts at the local and precinct level, with an eye on the 2022 and 2024 elections, and building more political alliances on issues such as vaccine requirements and mask mandates. The strategies Michael Flynn and Steve Bannon are deploying overlap those of other conservative outfits, such as the influential youth group Turning Point USA, to expand the pro-Trump base at the precinct level and work to elect Trump-backed politicians to key posts, such as Secretary of State in Georgia, in Arizona, and in various other battleground states. Michael Flynn and Steve Bannon have separately relied on a mix of non-profit groups, including one backed by the multimillionaire Patrick Byrne, conservative social media outlets favored by the far right, like Telegram, and events that convey evangelical Christian messages with political disinformation. Steve Bannon, for instance, has used his War Room podcast to espouse plans for taking over the Republican Party through the precinct committee strategy and invited would-be candidates to appear as guests. He claimed the podcast, which has millions of downloads, has found a large and receptive conservative following. Meanwhile, Michael Flynn touts the adage that local action has national impact and has been a star speaker in several key states at Reawaken America events, which are dubbed Health and Freedom conferences and combine evangelical themes with misinformation about the 2020 presidential election and vaccine skepticism. The conservative crusades by Michael Flynn and Steve Bannon come after Donald Trump pardoned them post-election for lying to the FBI and fraud, respectively. Steve Bannon and Michael Flynn also were central actors with other Trump loyalists in scheming about ways to block Congress from certifying Joe Biden's election, efforts that are under scrutiny as part of the House Select Committee investigation of the deadly Capitol attack by hundreds of Donald Trump supporters. As they have carved out new roles in the conservative ecosystem, Michael Flynn and Steve Bannon still support Trump's conspiratorial claims that he lost in 2020 due to massive cheating, a mantra that reinforces their drives to expand local and state electoral influence to give Republicans a better shot at recapturing Congress next year and the White House in 2024. Joanna Lydgate, chief executive of the state's United Democracy Center, said in a statement to The Guardian, "We're seeing a dangerous trend of election deniers lining up to fill election administration positions across the country," she added, "and the efforts by Michael Flynn, Steve Bannon and other promoters of the big lie are all part of this playbook to hijack elections in 2022 and 2024 if their preferred candidate doesn't win." Likewise, as they have revved up political work on multiple fronts, the two ex-Trump advisers have taken more extremist stances, sparking strong criticism. Michael Flynn, a retired Army Lieutenant General, has been skewed for his authoritarian-style advocacy of one religion for America and for speaking at some events with heavy presences by adherents of QAnon conspiracy movement. Michael Flynn's call for one religion came during a talk to a conservative Christian audience in Texas on the Reawaken America tour last November. Michael Flynn said, "If we're going to have one nation under God, which we must, we have to have one religion. One nation under God and one religion under God, right? All of us working together." According to Patrick Byrne, the multimillionaire founder of America Project that counts Michael Flynn as special advisor and spokesperson, Flynn's feature role at Reawaken America meetings in several states such as Michigan and Florida is hardly an accident. Patrick Byrne, who has joined Michael Flynn at some Reawaken rallies, said in text messages that he and Flynn had a large hand in launching the Reawaken tour during the spring by bankrolling the events with some tens of thousands of dollars from the America Project. Overall, Byrne said that the America Project has raised about $9.5 million, of which he donated close to $7 million. Patrick Byrne and the America Project poured over $3 million into a months-long audit of Arizona's largest county, which Donald Trump was banking on to find major fraud, but which resulted in no significant changes to Joe Biden's win there or overall in the state, much to Donald Trump's dismay. Patrick Byrne said the project has helped promote audits in other states besides Arizona, boasting a net worth about $75 million. Byrne is the ex-chief executive of furniture retailer Overstock. Patrick Byrne texted that he didn't vote for Donald Trump and deems himself a rule of law advocate who claims there's still a mountain of evidence to support the widely debunked allegations of voter fraud. Patrick Byrne's project has had no dearth of Trump links. The project's president until late last month was Emily Newman, a former Trump aide. According to multiple reports, Emily Newman, along with Patrick Byrne and Michael Flynn, attended a meeting in December of 2020 with Donald Trump about ways to block Joe Biden taking office, where Michael Flynn touted the option of declaring martial law and deploying the military to rerun the election in key states that Donald Trump lost. Patrick Byrne said Flynn's brother, Joe Flynn, has succeeded Emily Newman as the project's president. On top of his work with the America Project, Flynn's focus on expanding the MAGA base at the local level increased when he became chairman in May of another non-profit, America's Venture, which in turn has partnered with Turing Point USA and others to form a larger alliance dubbed County Citizens Defending Freedom USA. According to Florida lawyer Ron Filipkowski, a former prosecutor who authored a Washington Post article on the wave of local drives by Trump backers, the County Citizens Group has sponsored an array of training programs, protests, and candidate meetings with a focus on mask mandates, vaccine requirements, and critical race theory. For his part, Steve Bannon's heavy emphasis on a local precinct strategy to help Republicans' electoral fortunes combines conspiratorial and apocalyptic bravado. Steve Bannon told CNN in December that his War Room podcast is an organizing tool to expand Donald Trump's base. Bannon said, "It is about winning elections with the right people, MAGA people. We will have our people in at every level." Bannon said in November on his War Room podcast, "We're taking over all the elections. We're going to get to the bottom of last year's election and we're going to decertify the electors. And you're going to have a constitutional crisis. But you know what? We're a big and tough country and we can handle that. We'll be able to handle that. We'll get through that." Megan Squire, a computer science professor at Elon University, told The Guardian that much of Steve Bannon's political messaging has relied on alternative social media channels, such as Telegram, that appeal to conservative and far-right allies to spread pro-Trump gospel and help broaden the MAGA base at the local level. To Megan Squire, Steve Bannon's rhetoric and large audience look increasingly dangerous. Megan Squire said, "After being deplatformed from mainstream social media over the past year, Bannon has been promoting alternative permissive social media channels such as Telegram and Get. There, his listeners are able to amplify and intensify Bannon's messaging into a 24-hour-a-day echo chamber filled with disinformation, scams, and conspiracy theories." For Joanna Lydgate, the chief executive of the state's United Democracy Center, the multi-front drives by Steve Bannon, Michael Flynn, and other key Trump loyalists pose serious risks for the integrity of future elections. She said, "They want to sow doubt in our democracy and make it easier to undermine the will of the American voters."
Savior.
Oh, the Savior of mankind, please show us the sign.
to the designer of the human civilization that is established on the unity of Almighty Allah. To the redeemer of human volition and thought.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. You are listening to IRIB English Radio. This is your humble host, Zainab. Dear listeners, we had been talking about the various tricks that the false claimants of Mehdi use in order to trap innocent people. And on that note, we have with us in our studio Dr. Murtaza Karimi. Assalamu alaikum, doctor.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
Dr. Karimi, it's a pleasure to have you again on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Karimi, as we had been talking about these tricks, the false claimants of Mehdi use in order to trap people, we talked about one of the tricks in the previous episode, that was istikhara, which means kind of, you know, taking answer from God when people are confused a lot about taking decision. And then they use Quran in order to get the answer from Allah.
That's true, yeah.
Now, I want you to expand these same tricks. Are there any more tricks these claimants use in order to trap people?
Yes, sure. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. As you rightly mentioned, we refer to a few of them. And unfortunately, there are some more to it.
A number of tricks.
Inshallah, we are going to discuss about them so that we can give a true understanding of the true ways of recognizing the Imam, so that inshallah our dear listeners may be away from these so-called false claimants. Now, one of the tricks that is used by these false claimants, we call it to write a kind of arida. But before I talk about how they mislead the people through this trick, it's necessary for me to explain about what is arida all about.
Yeah.
Because there are some narrations regarding arida. We have some reports in our collection of hadith. So first we need to know the reality of arida. It is from the word, from the root arid, which means to present something to another person, for example. Technically speaking, arida is a kind of tawassul, resorting to the Imams of the Ahlul Bayt. It is a kind of dua, prayer, supplication. So sometimes you utter the words, utter your requests, but arida is in the form of a written text.
Mm-hmm.
You write down your request on a paper, and then there are some supplications to be read and recited, and then you throw that piece of paper, for example, to a river or to a well.
So this is how you rely on Imam or like whoever you want to rely on. You write a letter, you kind of put your whatever you want to say, you put it on the letter and then you throw it in the river, and this is called arida.
This is called arida, or writing arida. Now, first of all, we need to find that whether it is to begin with an Islamic way for tawassul or not.
Mm-hmm.
Because there are discussions regarding this, and
of
then
course.
We'll go to the what is done by the false claimants. Of course, at the time of the presence of the Imams, the Shia used to write letters, in person, and the Imams received the letters and answered them back. We are talking about our time, the period of major occultation. We have no access to the Imam of the time, may Allah hasten his reappearance, and we see some people writing down their requests, whatever they like to tell the Imam of the time, and then they throw that into a river or a well. Some people have, dedicated a special place for that. Inshallah, I will talk about that. The first one that I would like to mention is that it's not something new in the religion of Islam, because some people accuse Shia of bringing kind of bid'ah or innovation in the form of writing the arida. This is not true. We see it still common, especially among the Jews. In Baitul Maqdis or Jerusalem, there is a wall which is known as the Wailing Wall. or the Western Wall. We call it in Persian the Wall of Nutba.
Mm-hmm.
And we see that still people go there and they write down their requests and put it in the cracks in the in that wall.
Mm-hmm.
So it was something common before the religion of Islam. It's not something innovated by the Shia. Now, whether it is mentioned in the narrations of the Ahlul Bayt or not as a way of communication of the Shia at the time of the major occultation with the imam, their imam or not, there are some narrations in this regard. I mean, the narrations explain how Arida should be written, what are the conditions for which we are able to write Arida, what is the supplication for it, and so on and so forth. But the point is that, according to some scholars, we cannot find even one absolutely authentic narration in all the narrations quoted about Arida. For example, one of the points is that the oldest source that has quoted some narrations about that is the book by Erbili, who passed away in 692.
Mm-hmm.
And before him, no other Shia scholar has mentioned that. And the other quotes are from Kafami, who passed away in 905 after Hijra. The other problem is with the chain of the narrations.
Okay.
I mean, the chain is not complete. So technically speaking, the narrations are mursal, meaning that some of the narrators are
we
not...
We cannot rely on them.
Yeah, so we cannot rely on the narrations. Also, Allama Majlisi has quoted two narrations about Arida from a book, Atiq Gharawi, but today we do not have access to this book, so we cannot rely on these two narrations as well. So, if we want to talk about the authenticity of this way of Tawassul from a Shia perspective, the point is that we cannot attribute it in a certain manner to the Imams of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi wasalam, because, as I mentioned, the narrations are weak. So we cannot call it an Islamic tradition or even a Shia tradition to do that. But then, does it mean that it is a kind of innovation or bid'ah? Again, the answer is negative. We cannot call it a kind of innovation.
Okay.
Rather, we can do that, technically they call it for the hope of, getting reward. Mm-hmm. So it's not a recommended action rooted in authentic narrations. But because we have, although some weak narrations, the scholars say that for the recommended actions, we do tasamuh, a kind of so-called tolerance, for example, meaning that still for the recommended actions, we also, refer to the weak narrations as well. So from that perspective, we can say that people can do that, can write Arida, hoping that it is an act of worship, an act of tawassul.
An act of relying,
yeah,
basically.
Yeah.
So you're trying to say we have this Arida kind of thing in religion, which cannot be said that it's an innovation, and at the same time, we don't have very strong narrations supporting that.
Yeah.
Dr. Karimi, I'll be talking to you here. We need to take a short break. The listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
I can feel your eyes like the sun shining behind the clouds. I can hear your voice like a whisper calling me in the wind. I need a morning to shatter this long night forever. I need a hero to stop this thousand-year-old pain.
Welcome back. You are listening to IRIB English Radio. This is The Last Savior. We are talking about the tricks used by false claimants of Mahdawiyat who claim to be attached to Imam Mahdi Ajallullah Ta'ala Faraja. Dr. Karimi, you told us about Arida, which is not an innovation, which at the same time is not very much recorded in authentic narrations.
Mm-hmm.
Now, how do these claimants use this process as a trick?
So the conclusion that I tried to draw from what I mentioned before the break was that, first of all, people should not think that it is based on very strong narrations, and at the same time, people should not go to another extreme and call it an innovation.
Or a bit.
So it's very important for people not to go to extreme, because sometimes we have some people who call it a kind of superstition. This is not the case. Some people go to extreme and they believe that there are special places that are mentioned in the narrations. We need to put the arilla and the text only in those places. And one of them is, let me also talk about that before answering your question. One of them is, or rather was, a well in the Holy Mosque of Jamkaran.
All right.
And for many years, people used to go to that well and used to
write down there.
Yeah, and throw down the arilla into the well.
Right.
And gradually speaking, some non-Shia began to accuse the Shia that they are after superstitions. Even they forged some lies. For example, they said that some Shia believes that Imam Mahdi is residing in that well. He himself is receiving the letters which are thrown down.
So now the Shias were attributed with so many superstitious things.
That's the point. So what I mentioned, that we shouldn't go to extreme, that will maybe was one of the causes for that, because some people went to extreme. Some people, of course, they were very few in number, but they thought that there is something special for that will, which was not the case. And some people might even may have expected to see Imam Mahdi alayhi salam in that will, and so on and so forth.
Oh my God.
So you see, gradually speaking, it is bringing a kind of wrong understanding of the reality for the lovers of Imam Mahdi, may Allah hasten his reappearance. So is there anything specific for that will? No. It was just a well like the other wells. And according to some people, even there was no water in it. So if this is the case, even based on the narrations of Arila, you are not able to throw the Arila into that well.
You are supposed to throw an Ariza. Even if you're writing it, it should be like running water
or
something.
Yeah, running water, yeah. Mm. So that is why a few years ago, people in charge of the Mosque of Jamkaran decided to close that section of Jamkaran altogether, so that, I mean, they prevent these accusations against the Shia school of thought, and I think we need to appreciate that work.
Right.
So we should not go to extreme. But what is the philosophy of that? Let me also refer to this point that, I mean, psychologically speaking, we may think of some positive points. We are living in a time that we have no access to the Imam of the time. Sometimes when you are in much trouble, just to write a letter to the Imam of the time, it is, I mean, relieving you of your anxieties.
Have you ever written an Ariza?
Maybe when I was between 15 or to 17 years of old, it was the beginning years that I came to the Hausa Seminary of Rome. And I saw that people are doing that in the Mosque of Jamkaran. I think I did that once, maybe.
All right.
Yeah, and, but at that time, it was not that famous among the people. Only few people knew about that and used to do that. So my point is that even psychologically speaking, there is something positive in writing Arida. Although we may talk to Imam Mahdi, may Allah hasten his reappearance, but some people may prefer to write down their problems, their requests, or even a kind of friendly talk to Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, and just throw it in the water, hoping that, I mean, Imam Mahdi alayhi salam will receive that, metaphorically speaking. So I mean that it shouldn't be looked as a kind of superstition.
Even we have so many religious narrations, narrations exactly, but we have some way outs of coming out of backbiting. For example, when your heart is filled, you are troubled enough, and now you want to speak to someone. So it's better, like if you start speaking to a person after somebody's back, and now in order to like lighten up your heart, so that way you're indulging yourself into backbiting. But the best way to lighten up your heart is to write an Ariza, I guess.
That's true. That's true.
Dr. Murtaza will be talking about these tricks in the next episode. Thank you so much for being on the show.
My pleasure.
To listeners, you were listening to IRIB English Radio. I bid you a goodbye from my side and Dr. Murtaza's side. Take care till next episode.
Where is the rising sun? Where is the spring of life? Where is the shining moon? Where is the firmest rose? Please, oh please,
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.